CliffCentral.com.
Yes, In Your Eyes. It's the weekend. Very, very nice. That's a great song. Love it to pieces. Not over that band at all. How long have they been going? Like 4 or 5 years now? And they just keep churning out hit after hit after hit. In Your Eyes. Well, CliffCentral.com on the 6th of October. It's a Tuesday morning. It's just after 7. And there was some significant rain over Gauteng last night, which is very good. In fact, we were in a hailstorm while we were filming the TV show yesterday. You could hear it through the studio walls. It was crazy.
Shucks.
Yeah. You heard it too, right, Sia?
Yeah, well, we were confused for a while because there aren't any windows in the studio. It's all dark. And we thought maybe it was a guest who has their mic on in the wrong time. And we were trying to see, is it a technical issue?
Yeah.
And we spent a couple of minutes really trying to crack what was going on up until someone who had been outside said, like, it's a mess out there.
Wow. I love when there's rain, but I get a little bit nervous when there's hail. It just does so much damage, you know, destroys stuff and people end up having to make massive insurance claims, et cetera, et cetera. All right. Right.
Were you not stuck in traffic yesterday after you left? Because we finished at about 3 or 4 in the afternoon.
No, there's no traffic. No, I think.
Well, because, you know, it's a given. People lose their ability to drive and the robots weren't working. No. It just felt like another glorious day in Johannesburg.
It was a normal. It was fairly normal on the roads, but I think that's also because most people aren't, you know, 100% back in the office. There are still people who are working from home and many people who are working remotely. So I don't know exactly how it's working, but certainly the traffic is not where it was. So here are a couple of points. First of all, Carol sent me an article about Donald Trump, which is interesting. Apparently, he weighs 111 kilograms. He is 190 centimeters tall. Sure, he's taller than me, eh? He has a body mass index of just over 30, which actually does put him in the obese range. Okay. All right. Well, there we go. That's for people who are interested.
Carol, thank you for your research, but how do you have something like that on hand?
She just got it from, it looks like Google, but this is an article from some news service, so I have no reason not to believe it. Apparently, studies have shown 75-year-olds have a 42% chance of dying from coronavirus. But I don't know that that's true. I heard figures in the 90s of survival. So I'm not sure. I'm not going to pretend I know exactly what's going on there. And the Trump White House and the medical experts involved in the Trump White House and reporting on Donald Trump's condition have been anything but transparent. So it's very hard to figure out what's actually going on here. The point is, the guy's fine.
Right.
So all of this doesn't matter. This is purely academic. It's purely theoretical. And it has no bearing on the fact that he's back up and running. He landed at the White House last night and appeared on the balcony, and he seems to be fine. He took his mask off. He's walking. He walked from Marine One all the way in. And he seems to be raring to go. So this is not, 4.2% chance. Carol's just corrected me, not a 42% right. chance. It just, the article cut off.
I'm surprised we haven't really heard much from the First Lady in this time.
Yeah, I'm sure she's okay too. So that's really
interesting. She's just been indoors.
I want to read you something quickly that someone sent me that I thought was really, really interesting. And it explains, you know, I get a lot of people who ask me, do you support Donald Trump? And I really don't, because I never used to be a fan of The Apprentice. I know people who watched The Apprentice and loved the show. And they said, oh, you know, the show's about the business world and this guy is he's a smart businessman, et cetera, et cetera. I never really paid much attention to Donald Trump. I knew him, but it's only in his role as president of the United States that I've really been paying attention. But here's something interesting someone sent me. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but it's interesting because it addresses, for people who can't understand why there are sensible people in the world who are backing Trump in this election and who think that he's not as bad as other people seem to say he is, particularly in the media and in the Democratic Party. So listen to this quickly, and maybe, you know, if you're an open-minded person, maybe this will explain something to you. It certainly explains a lot about my position. And I don't know who wrote it, so I can't even give credit to the person who authored this. There is no author. But listen to this. If you are a liberal who can't stand Trump, and you cannot possibly fathom why conservatives would ever vote for him, let me fill you in. It is not that we love Donald Trump so much. It is that we can't stand you. And we will do whatever it takes, even if that means electing a rude, obnoxious, unpredictable narcissist, your words, not ours, to the office of President of the United States. Because the only thing we find more dangerous to the world than Donald Trump is you. So I know this is probably shocking and horrifying to some people, but just let me read on. Because it's really, I feel like this is hitting at a nerve, which will help some people to at least understand why anyone could like Donald Trump. Or why anyone could elect Donald Trump. How is it possible, you might ask? Well, you have done everything in your power to destroy America, from tearing down the police to tearing down our history to tearing down our borders. You are systematically destroying our schools, brainwashing our kids into believing socialism is the answer to anything, despite being an unmitigated failure everywhere, while demonizing religion and faith and glorifying abortion, violence, and thug culture. You call everybody racists every time we expect anyone of skin color to follow the same laws that we follow, to telling us that our tolerance of lifestyles we don't agree with isn't nearly enough. No, we must celebrate any lifestyle choice or gender option you throw in our direction, or you think it's fine to call us homophobic or some other degrading slur. And ironically, all of this while lecturing us on hate speech, while you gaslight us about 52 genders, polyamory, grown men in dresses sharing public locker rooms with little girls, and you normalize the sexualization of young children, you simultaneously ridicule us for having the audacity to wish someone a Merry Christmas or having a flag hanging outside our houses on the 4th of July, standing for the national anthem, or donning a MAGA hat in public. So much for your tolerance. Do you see why we think you're hypocrites? And it goes on. And I thought this was interesting just because it does explain why middle America and a silent majority of Americans are turning away from the Democrats. It's not because they love Donald Trump, because he's such a great guy. It's because they can't stand these leftists. And I just think that's really interesting as an observation, because if we're going to talk about this stuff, we need to have different points of view brought to us. And this is a point of view that someone sent to me. Look, by no means do I accept it whole scale. In fact, there are lots of things in that that paragraph or two that I didn't agree with at all. But the general sentiment that Donald Trump is a horrible person, but that the people he's standing against seem almost worse, that makes a little bit of sense to me. So I thought it would be worth throwing that in. We've got Germ joining us just now. I'll tell you about that. And episode 3 of Blind History. Today we go to Che Guevara in South America. Now, I think that this is probably one of the most interesting people I didn't know a thing about before I started doing the research. And Blind History is obviously becoming a fast favorite. And I know how many people love these episodes, so we've got a new one for you every week, running right up to Christmas this year for season 4. Che Guevara, a pop icon and inspiration to the rebels of the world. And we've got lots of other information about him today in Blind History. Let's turn our attention to Germ for a second. Jeremy Nell's been a guest on our show a number of times. He's also a famous South African cartoonist. He's probably the second most, if not the most famous cartoonist in South Africa. He does great work, and a lot of it pushes boundaries and upsets a lot of people. He definitely has a political bent, as most cartoonists in history have had. There's no such thing as an objective cartoonist. They're not trying to be journalists, but they are social commentators. And I wonder where the lines of censorship start and stop, because Germ told me last week he's been banned from YouTube, and there seems to be a campaign to deplatform him everywhere. So he's now making plans to get onto platforms where they can't get to him, they, whoever they are. So Germ, first of all, how are you doing, man?
Yeah, morning, Gareth. Sorry, I was having some issues with the technical side of things, but I think everything's fine as long as I can be heard.
We can hear you and we can see you, which is good. So first of all,
that's a good start.
Yeah, no, that's a good thing. Our eyes and ears work, and so does the technology. We're off to a great start. So first of all, what happened with YouTube? Because Facebook deplatformed you last year?
Yeah, so So there's a bit of context here. So Facebook, my fan page, not my personal page. Obviously, there's a difference, like the business page, which had around about 60,000 fans. And of course, that's not a lot in the grand scheme of things, but for me, it was a lot.
Sure.
And it took me a while to get to that number. And I kept on getting messages from Facebook saying, look, you're violating the rules. You're violating the rules. This post has been removed. That post has been removed. Please read the community standard guidelines so that you don't do this again. Of course, they don't tell you what it is.
They don't tell you which part of the community standards you're violating. And it could be anything. I mean, those community standards are everything from like encouraging suicide and wishing death on someone, which is obviously not good, right the way through to upsetting somebody by misgendering them by mistake.
Yeah, well, let me give an example. Okay, so I mean, I won't spend too much time on the Facebook thing, but let me give an example of one of the posts that actually led to my ultimate ban on Facebook was there was this guy, I forget his name now. He was found guilty of raping a minor, I think, and he spent something like 12 years in jail.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, new DNA evidence came out that showed that he had not done that, and he was found to have been not guilty.
Right. So,
and I shared that story.
It was wrongly accused. Yeah.
Correct. Yes. And I shared that story, and I ridiculed the hashtag Men Are Trash.
Right.
That got my suspension finalized, because I was the bad guy in the story.
This is a bit weird.
And so that sort of pattern continued.
A bit weird.
Well, you could argue that the algorithms don't understand.
Yeah, but is it the algorithms, or is it because these days if you don't go with mainstream opinion on things, that you must be silenced? I mean, I don't want to be conspiratorial about this, but it does seem that there's no – what is the appeal process in a situation like that? Can you
– Well, look. Look, so it's a combination of algorithms, which I think is the minor part of the story. The major part of the story is targeted attacks by various people who want to take you down. They want to cancel you. And all they do is, and it's, they've admitted it. A number of people have admitted it online. They go in groups and they mass report anything that they think is potentially offensive or they don't like, anything to get you down. Taken down, and so they just keep going until they win. That's what they do. They do it in numbers. They're doing it on Twitter. They're doing it on YouTube. The same thing. They're using the mass report feature, which is why Andrew Doyle was correct when he said to me last year, at least on Twitter, when you block people, you stop them from mass reporting. Muting doesn't stop them from doing that. And so we need to actually learn that blocking is okay, because it's not foolproof, but it certainly makes it a bit more difficult.
How does that work? Just explain to me. So if some, in inverted commas, activist, some person who probably doesn't have work and sits in their parents' house and they're tweeting about, you know, social issues because they want to feel part of a struggle. If that person complains about you, but you've blocked them, their complaint doesn't get registered?
Well, they can't complain about you because, remember, they have to be able to access your profile and click on the report.
So in other words, you've got to block these people.
Yes, you have to. And I didn't agree with that initially, but as I said, Andrew and a number of these intellectuals around the world in the what's known as the intellectual dark web have stated now that blocking, at least on Twitter, is a better strategy. It's not foolproof, but it's better than nothing.
Okay, so it's a way to get back. Now, what the latest controversy is about, you've got to tell us, because this is YouTube. And YouTube, really, they allow almost anything on YouTube, except copyright infringement, which they regulate quite well. What was the problem here? Was it one of your podcast shows? Was it one of your cartoons? Was it some other piece of content that you developed? What was the problem?
It's the gold. That's the million-dollar question. So I did a show with the Kiffness. Of all guests that you can possibly have, the one with the Kiffness.
Yeah, but the Kiffness has been – we were told reliably by the guy from Ekurhuleni, the mayor of Ekurhuleni, Musina, that the Kiffness is some kind of deep racist and white supremacist. That's, we were told that very reliably. Is that not true?
Deep state.
Yeah, I mean, isn't he just a parody artist who has a great sense of humor and a musical talent? And I failed to pick up any of his white supremacy, and I've heard a lot of his songs. In fact, we had him on the show during lockdown. Is he some kind of racist that we don't know about?
No, listen, if he is, he's really, really good at hiding it.
So he's very covert, this guy.
Extremely covert. Listen, disliking him is like disliking a waterfall. I mean, it makes no sense. So that was the trigger, that particular conversation.
What did you both talk to him about? What was there substance in there that would have been outrageous?
No. Lots of people watched, and not a single, even his mother watched. And no one knows what it is that we said. We've spoken about it. We don't know what the trigger was. The video was taken down within 20 minutes, and here we go. And then my live streaming ability was revoked. No reason given other than you have violated the community standard guidelines. There we go. Yeah, same story. Don't know what it is. It says you can click on the link, but it's a long page. You don't know what you know. It's so vague. You don't know what it is, and that's it. And I appealed. I went to the YouTube appeal center, which happens to have humans. But I say humans in inverted commas because I don't think they actually type anything. I think they've got set replies that they just click because the replies are so clinical and automated. They just basically doubled down and said, I violated the community guidelines. And I said, what is it? They said, well, please have a look at this link for more information.
And then what gives you the community rules but doesn't show
yeah.
you?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so cyclical.
So, Jerm, I mean, we know that we're building up to a very fractious, very contentious U.S. election at the moment. We know Silicon Valley is in they're in the pocket of Joe Biden and his campaign at the moment. They're funding that pocket, if nothing else. And we know YouTube owned by Google and Facebook owned by Mark Zuckerberg along with Instagram. These are very much left-leaning platforms. So we're not terribly surprised they'd be involving themselves in American politics and trying to count out conservative and right of center voices. But in South Africa, what's their interest here? And who are these people who keep reporting you to YouTube and Facebook? I mean, do we know who they are? Are they South Africans?
We know who some of them are. They definitely exist. They are anonymous. That's their power. They are anonymous, and there are a lot of them. We know who some of them are, and that's the problem. I have a feeling now that people need to stop turning the other cheek, Gareth. Stop turning the other cheek and going, ugh, if you ignore them, they go away. Gareth, they don't go away.
Yeah, well, you're proof of that, and I think more people are going to start fighting back. So how do we do this? Besides blocking them on Twitter, you know, I've tried really hard to not go on Twitter at all. But this is the main nest of vipers, right?
I think I want to quit Twitter as well at some point soon. I don't know, Gareth. I don't know. Other than just trying to find out who they are and hitting back with the same sort of force. In other words, if they get the Kiffness cancelled, then they must be cancelled as a reaction. I don't know.
Yeah. I think if you dox someone,
I don't know.
I think if you dox someone, you should be doxed. You know, if you throw the first stone, then it is acceptable morally and ethically to have you compromised as well, because these are the same people who will cry foul and they'll say, oh, this is victimization and you're putting me in danger, you know, and all of that stuff as soon as anyone takes aim at them, but they're more than happy to take aim at everyone else and destroy their livelihoods, mm-hmm. as they've tried to do with you a number of times. So all right, if you can't use YouTube, what can you use?
I've tried Vimeo, which is now the second largest video platform in the world. Now, wait for it. My very first conversation was with an engineer using the Vimeo platform to live stream. We chatted about, so the title was, should you take a COVID-19 vaccine? It's a question, and the entire discussion is based around the problem, Gareth, with rushed vaccines. Now, we know that this particular vaccine is being rushed. You know, I'm not going to chat about that. I'm just telling you the context. Mm-hmm. And I obviously think that it's a dumb idea to be vaccinated with something that was rushed. And so our entire conversation was about...
Also, it seems that it might not even be necessary. We may have developed some herd immunity by the time this thing comes out.
Yes. And we specifically stated in the conversation, guys, this is not an anti-vax conversation. We are in favor of vaccinations. And I put about 6 science paper links under the video in the description so that anybody watching can see that this is a good conversation. Well, Gareth, that conversation was taken down by Vimeo. Said that I violated its community guidelines on vaccinations.
Well, you're certainly attracting the attention of every big platform in the world, and that's got to be worth something, Germ. I don't know what you're doing, but it's clearly pissing some people off.
Well, I lost a very big contract, a very big cartoon contract during lockdown because of my views of opposing the mitigation measures to this pandemic.
Which, by the way, have all proven to be absolutely correct. On the money in your respect, yes. In respect of your opinions, yes, rather. All of the lockdown evidence is now starting to come in, and it's making governments look very stupid. So.
Did you see Business Day yesterday? They ran an article saying that Netcare has brought out numbers suggesting that they may have overstated the pandemic.
Oh, you think? It's unbelievable. We had Nick Hudson from Panda on last week, and revelations that he put out there. I mean, a lot of people are saying that that's also propaganda, but I defy them to go and find the statistics and to argue with him on the basis of fact. Not your opinion, not the way that COVID makes you feel or your thoughts about government, but the facts around the statistics related to this disease. Mm-hmm. And it's damning.
Exactly right.
It makes governments across the world, not just our government in this country, makes them all look like complete arse about face ignoramuses.
Yeah. So just to quickly answer your question, so where to? So I've got a new channel on YouTube that I set up just as an interim solution, because since Vimeo and YouTube have got the same guidelines, I might as well use YouTube because it's the bigger platform by a mile. However, and I don't want to say anything yet, but I am working on with a team of people that might be a solution to this whole problem for people like me and those of us who want to do live streams and conversations online.
Okay.
But this is going to take a few months of planning, but there is definitely something happening. We aren't just sitting back and having a snooze.
In other words, they're not going to get to cancel you.
Definitely not. That's the plan.
You're not just going to go away and be a good boy and stop bothering everybody.
No. But yes, the wonderful thing also that I want to say, they can keep coming for us. And I know you've also had your fair share of attacks, and they can keep coming for us. But one thing is for certain, we get stronger every single time.
Like immunity to a virus.
Yes, correct. Yes. we get herd immunity.
So, what is the motivation? I mean, I get very passionate about certain subjects, you know, history and archaeology and architecture and science, and there's so much stuff that I'm really interested in the world, but none of it that I would actually go to the trouble of trying to destroy someone else's career in order to learn or to be closer to or to understand. It's almost as if there's a religious fervor that has crept in around political ideology. Do you have any explanation for that? Do you have any sensible way of ordinary people, like, you know, there are lots of people in this world who are not political. They're not that interested in politics. They want to raise their kids, or they want to live happily. They don't want to interfere with other people's lives. They don't want to make rules for other people. They don't care what your gender or your sexual preference or your race or any of that stuff is. They just want to get on with their lives. And those people are confused, Germ, that people like you are always getting into trouble for what seem to them to be mostly fairly mainstream views. I mean, it's not as if you espouse any particularly egregious views. You've been called lots of things. Of course, nobody can prove that you are any of those things. And that seems to be the only weapon in the arsenal of those people who oppose you, is that they call you names and they try to have you cancelled for your opinions. When it comes to proving anything, it's a lot more difficult for them. And yeah. I'm confused as to how to explain this to people who don't get it, who are maybe not even that interested, but need to get a handle on it so that it doesn't come for them eventually. How do we explain this?
Yeah, I actually was having this exact conversation yesterday with a bunch of Americans, actually, on WhatsApp about why there seems to be this identitarian polarization that has crept into every aspect of our zeitgeist. Now, if you remember, Bush was very hated, okay, in the early 2000s, and you know, it was fair play, and he was an idiot in many respects. Mm-hmm. And I thought it could never get worse than that. Well, I was wrong. I've never seen so much hatred and polarization as I have since the election of Trump. Now, I don't know what it is. He's not Kim Jong, what's his
Kim
name?
Kim Jong-un. Yeah.
Kim Jong-un. Yeah. He was democratically elected. So what could this be? So Gareth, I've got a hypothesis that I cannot prove, but I suspect that there's a correlation between the rise of social media and people that you dislike in positions of power.
Hang on. I don't know if you watched
that
again.
I don't know if you watched a couple of
hold on. You broke up. You said you have a hypothesis about social media and the rise of that, and then it got confusing.
Right. So I think that there is a sense of polarization that is occurring because of the fact that people can quickly log on anonymously, particularly onto any platform. They get massive, massive audiences that they otherwise didn't have, say, during Bush's time. Mm-hmm. And now they can create a false machinery of hatred and polarization. And it's the easiest thing in the world to go onto Twitter now and say, I think Gareth Cliff is an idiot. And suddenly you can get 500 people agreeing with you, all anonymous. Mm. And suddenly, before you know it, that thread of conversation has led to all kinds of things and accusations. And suddenly, Gareth Cliff is on the street lights, you know, on the street lamps tomorrow as a headline. And I have a suspicion that social media is correlated to this polarization. My wife agrees with me, but there's no evidence. This is just my own hypothesis. But okay, I can't think of any other reason.
So you're saying the numbers are inflated artificially by social media because there are, you know, there are people all over the world who have maybe three or four anonymous accounts, or it's Russian bots or whatever it might be. But you can't believe, I mean, I don't think there's anyone in the world who goes, we've got to believe the numbers on social media. It's bullshit. Absolute nonsense.
It is bullshit. It is bullshit.
But the problem is also that journalists, serious news people, use Twitter as the barometer for whether or not a story is true. And this is dangerous because it means if something is completely manufactured out of thin air by someone on Twitter and it gathers enough traction, the media will report on it.
Exactly. And that happened with me and The Citizen and God bless his soul, Daniel Friedman. Shame.
He got fired, right?
Yeah, I'll raise some money for him. I got 64 and 72. And maybe it'll buy him a cup of coffee. But what happened to him?
He was fired from The Citizen?
Yes, but he was involved in peddling fake stories, and he was getting his fake stories from Twitter. I was one of his targets. And eventually it came to fruition that he was talking nonsense. You know, when you say things like right wing and you in your column you make associations with Nazis and white supremacists, this is a problem, Gareth. It's a big problem. And it has to get attacked back. There needs to be a counterattack. You can't just throw around terms like Nazi as easily as people are doing today, for example.
Well, my worry with too many people who use they say that someone is exactly like Hitler or someone's a Nazi or someone's a right-wing extremist or a white supremacist, all of this terminology, when you throw it around, it has the effect of making real Nazis and white supremacists, and there are still some. There are some very, very awful people in this world. It has the effect of making them a lot braver because they think that it's mainstream. And it also has the effect of making people who are actually not those things the target of massive, unfair public uproar. It diminishes the strength of those labels, which should be applied to people who are truly dangerous to society. I mean, you are, for all the things you've done and said, and there's a lot of stuff that you've said and done that is controversial. There's a lot of stuff that you've said and done that a lot of us wouldn't agree with. But none of what you've said has inspired hatred, to my knowledge. You're a cartoonist, for God's sake. Cartoonists have always been like the court jester of the media. And you guys hold up a mirror to the most ridiculous people in society, and you hold up a mirror to the most ridiculous ideas in society. And society has to learn to take cartoonists seriously some of the time and not some of the time.
Yeah.
That's not your responsibility.
No, and I mean, I don't see myself as having any kind of role. I just do what I do, you know, what I kind of grew into, like you, you know, you kind of grew into what you're doing. But I do take great pride in ridicule. Now, that is the crux of why I've been paid for the last 15 years, is to ridicule. And it's to ridicule things, Gareth, that I think are stupid or mediocre. I don't ridicule excellence. Because what is the point?
Yeah.
I take the piss out of things that I think are stupid. That obviously makes me look arrogant and self-important. But yes, of course, that's part of the territory. Because if you're taking the piss out of something, it means that you assume that you know better. And so as such, I come across as a prick. And I'm okay with that.
So one last thing, because we're running out of time here. Mm-hmm. Truth.
Cool.
There's this huge emphasis on truth in the media at the moment. Who's telling the truth? Can we believe, you know, McEnany, the president's press secretary? Can we believe that's Donald Trump's press secretary? Can we believe the ANC when they keep talking about corruption, but they do nothing to stem it? Can we believe the media, who've been selling us this coronavirus hysteria for the longest time? If there is truth out there, does it matter anymore? Because we say, you know, you hear intellectuals talking about a post-truth world and a Trump post-truth world. Does any of that stuff hold any sway? And what is your take on truth at the moment? What can you believe?
Great question. I've got this theory that I'm sort of developing that, yes, there is truth coming from large positions, say CNN, Fox, Trump's secretary, ANC, whatever, right? But I've got this argument that I'm developing that I think is strong. I think that people need to start aligning truth and facts with the distance from power. Let me try and explain. So the closer the source of truth, be, I don't know, let's say Cyril's PA or Trump's team or whatever, right? The closer they are to a position of power, the less likely or the more risky it is to trust what they're saying. In other words, the more independent, the more decentralized the source of information is, I think, the greater the degree of trust we should have in them. Does that make sense?
It does, to a degree. It sounds a little bit like a perverted version of critical theory, but I got you.
I'm just saying that I'm more likely to believe you, Gareth, that speaking about something related to you than, I don't know, IOL. Because remember, it's about skin of the game, as Tim Taleb puts it. If you've got more to lose, then you're more likely not to worry about the truth. That's what I'm saying. So Cyril Ramaphosa has got no skin in the game. It doesn't matter what happens after this pandemic. He's still going to be a billionaire. And he's still going to be perfectly, perfectly fine, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
But you and I might not.
Yeah, but so we've got more skin in the game. By that rationale, like Jacob Zuma is really in a difficult position at the moment. He's in a corner. They're coming at him. He has every reason in the world to either keep lying or tell the truth. According to your theory, he has skin in the game, so we must believe him. Well, you see what I mean?
Because he's a bit of a problem.
Well, no, but they're closing the net on him. I mean, clearly the guy is feeling more frustrated than ever. He keeps appealing, and it's not working.
No. That's correct what you're saying. I'm not saying that you disregard. I'm saying that the degree of reliability, I think, is greater the further away you are from centralized power.
I'll leave it at that, because this is something that obviously you're still working on, and it's something I'm constantly wrestling with. You know, who do you believe? What's credible? I think these are problems that these are 21st century problems that, thanks to social media, you don't know who to believe. And we've got to
definitely think social media is a problem, Gareth.
Yeah, we've got to re-engineer our matrix for figuring out what's real and what's not real, because it's become very hard to figure that out. But we will save that for another day. Listen, let me know when you launch your own platform of some kind, and let me know how the new YouTube channel's going, and we'll talk soon.
cool. Thanks, guys.
All right. Jeremy Nell, Germ. You can find him on YouTube. He's opened up a brand new channel there, and you can go and see what he's up to. It is time for Blind History. Yes, the newest episode in season 4. It is Che Guevara. What an interesting guy. I didn't know a lot about him until I researched this episode, and I'm glad I had to do the work because he's pretty damn interesting. There are things about him that I had no idea he was involved in. There are things about him that actually warmed me to him in ways that I didn't expect. An adventurer, a husband. He was a medical student. This episode of Blind History takes us from Argentina to Guatemala, then from Mexico to Cuba. We even stop in the Congo, and our journey finally ends in Bolivia. Very exciting stuff. So take a listen to that. That's Che Guevara, episode 3 of season 4 of Blind History, which is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. Whether he was slashing his way through the jungles of Central America, riding his Norton 500cc motorbike across continents, fighting for freedom, or preaching the gospel of socialism, Che Guevara had no idea he'd eventually end up on t-shirts, mostly worn by spoilt white kids in America. He would become a capitalist brand icon for the enemy, and he'd be buried without his hands. Things didn't go the way Che had planned. We've touched on a lot of parts of the world through the course of Blind History, all 4 seasons up to now. The one place that's really only got a little bit of representation is South America. And we return to South America today and to the Caribbean when we discuss a guy who most people know the face of, even if they know nothing about him. That is Che Guevara. Why? Because his face is on any number of t-shirts and coffee mugs and pretty much any kind of paraphernalia you can find. He's well known as a liberator and a Marxist revolutionary, but we'll find out a little bit more about him today. So, Anthony Medera and I, your co-hosts for Blind History, are here to give you yet another introduction into the story of someone who I think has had an enormous impact on the 20th century, even if he didn't actually end up conquering quite as much territory as people like to think he did. Anthony Medera is the big boss of Taylor Blinds and Shutters. They are the people who bring you Blind History. And today we're looking at a man whose life ended with the blinds closed and whose life began with the blinds wide open. I mean, he was born as almost an aristocrat in Argentina, and he grew up to be this guerrilla leader, this military theorist. He was a major figure in the Cuban Revolution, and he's become ubiquitous as a countercultural symbol in all the world. So, Ant, what's your overall take of Che Guevara before we go into his biog?
Yeah, so I knew about him growing up, as you mentioned. I think most of us did. But when I started digging in depth, I mean, I found him very, very interesting. And what he did is he stuck to his ideologies, and to such an extent that he scared off even the likes of Fidel Castro. You know, he was so staunch in what he believed in. And you can't fault him for that.
So he was born Ernesto Guevara, and he was born in 1928 in Rosario, Argentina, eldest of 5 children. They were a middle-class family, but they had money, which in South America at that point was pretty much equivalent to being upper class anywhere else. And he was actually born Ernesto, but they started calling him Che pretty early on because of his restless nature. And his father was the first one to remark on this. He also had a little bit of asthma, which plagued him throughout life. He played rugby, interestingly enough, Ant. Did you see that?
Yes, I did see that. He was a distinguished athlete. He swam, played rugby. He graduated with honors. So clearly he was hardworking, and he loved sport as well. So, yeah, well-rounded, I suppose. But I think his family and his friends were left-leaning in terms of their political views. So he got a lot of that in his teens.
Certainly from his mother, who made him read all the works of Sartre and Kafka and, you know, people like that. So she was a big influence on him, and Karl Marx came into his library early on. But he was an educated guy. He was certainly intelligent. He impressed lots of his friends, who were sometimes much older than him, with his knowledge of politics. And he eventually wanted to become a medical student, which he did end up doing. And you know, studying medicine, you can't be slow and stupid there. You have to be pretty sharp. And Che was that, if nothing else.
Just prior to that, Gareth, before he graduated, he joined a group opposing the government of Juan Perón. And we we had Eva Peron on Blind History 3. So this was in 1942. And in 1946, that's really where she came to light in government. But that's interesting. There's a small little overlap. And then when he did go to medical school, he halted his studies to go on his very famous bike trip.
Yeah, so this is quite exciting because he had a bike called Ponderosa, right?
Correct.
And he took Ponderosa through pretty much all of South America. I mean, this is really a big adventure. And remember, this is the 1940s, roughly. And he went through Machu Picchu in the Andes. He went to the very south of Chile. He went up to Venezuela, Panama. It was really an extraordinary trip. And during that motorcycle trip of his, he wrote the motorcycle diaries. You know, he kept a very good journal almost throughout his entire life, you know, detailing his thoughts on, you know, poverty and the state of humanity. And he ended up working in a leper colony for a while, which was interesting because I think that probably had more of an impact on him and on his philosophy and on his ideology of helping the poor and raising people out of extreme poverty and deprivation. And liberation became the main purpose of his life from that point on.
That was his big turning point. I think he always wanted to do what he can for the poor and the people that were downtrodden. And this was highlighted with the lepers. Nobody wanted to touch them. But what he noticed was they were very strong together. They were self-contained and they thrived on their own while being ostracized by the outside world. So that struck a chord with him.
Ultimately, his bike trip took him to Guatemala. And that was really where he set out on a mission to try and begin the liberation movement, which he envisioned would happen for all of South America. But Guatemala had just recently been taken over by Arbenz, who was the dictator there. He was a military man. And in fact, most of South America, let's be honest, at that stage was run by military juntas, you know, by generals who had basically pretended to liberate these countries, but in effect had taken them over as dictators. And this Arbenz was supposedly a democratically elected official, and he'd started some land reform and some other things. But Che thought that this was not good enough.
I think that what happened was the CIA-backed leftist government actually came in and overthrew him. And that's where he came in and joined the resistance in Guatemala. And that's actually where he met his wife as well, funny enough. But I think that was critical. At the time, just prior to that, the self-proclaimed dictator, I suppose, the military dictator, he was looking towards liberating, taking farms, land reform, et cetera, for the poorer people. And then he was overthrown. And I think that's the burning desire that came also from Che was the hatred for United States.
Oh, absolutely. It was probably at that time that he decided that the United States as an imperialist power were the most evil people in the world. And he dedicated himself to fighting not only the United States as an imperial power, but capitalism in general. He said, you know, it reduced people to a state of perpetual slavery, and he was not a fan. It has to be said at this point that much of South and Central America was actually owned by American companies. And this didn't do much to endear them to the local population because often they would just buy up these properties or just seize them from local people. And they wouldn't necessarily even grow things there. And then the people just outside of these properties would be starving.
That's exactly what happened. And that's what they tried to achieve in Guatemala was in the underground fight was to change that. And the fight went to an extent where they attacked one of the large United States farming group that owned massive amounts of land. And I think that's where the CIA started to figure out who is this guy.
They certainly got him onto their radar. Yeah. Now, you mentioned his wife. I mean, listen, the guy was a political animal from beginning to end because even his honeymoon, they went to Chichen Itza, which is the famous Mayan pyramid complex in Mexico. That was their honeymoon. It was a political statement. And he was planning to go and work as a doctor. And at this point, obviously, his revolutionary credentials had started to shine through. So he decided to make friends with a couple of people who we've also become very familiar with, the Castro brothers, Raul, who he met first, who's still in charge of Cuba as it is now, and his brother Fidel, who ultimately would become the revolutionary leader that eventually overthrew Batista and took over Cuba. And the two became fast friends, although that friendship became frayed later on, and we'll get to that.
Yeah, they all met in Mexico, which seemed to be a great place for all the revolutionaries at the time, because Che was there and Raul was there. But Raul was also, he was also operating in underground in Guatemala. So he had to bail. And the same applied actually Shay hid in the Argentinian embassy in Guatemala, and then they let him go to Mexico, and then his wife joined him later, or his girlfriend at the time joined him later on in Mexico.
So I think at this point in his life, Che really had become a bit of a rallying cry for some of the people in Central and South America, and he had started the rallying cry, rather, for people in South and Central America. And it was starting to become obvious that the best place to strike wasn't Guatemala, wasn't Mexico, but was instead Cuba. And of course, the Castro brothers were helpful in giving him some understanding of the terrain and the territory and the political goings-on of Cuba. So they decided they were going to invade, and they got on what they call a yacht, but it was really, it was like an old leaky cabin cruiser. It was called the Granma. Yeah. And they set off for Cuba in 1956. And they pretty much,
and they got lost.
Yeah, they got lost, and they were all seasick because none of them were sailors. And as soon as they landed, as I think pretty much all of them got killed or executed upon capture. I think only 22 of them survived and found each other afterwards.
Correct. And there's a famous story about that. This is where he really became a revolutionary, because like you said, there were just a few of them left upon landing, and now they were going to head into the mountains. So he quickly went back to get his medical equipment. And while the Baptistas, his forces were chasing them, and he saw his medical box and he saw an ammunition box. And then he ended up picking the ammunition box up and running back with it instead of the medical box.
Yeah, it was interesting. There's all those pictures of him at that time, like on a mule, making his way through the mountains of Cuba. But that choice was the choice that he says changed his life. And obviously picking up the ammo box, he realized like this was his future.
Correct. What you rightly said was he was going to be a doctor. And then he thought, look, in the underground, he can be a medic, you know, supporting the troops. But when he was trained by Castro and the crew and hard training in the mountains, they said, shoot, this guy's, he was one of the best guerrillas. So he really became one of the true frontline fighters for Castro's team.
Now, Castro made him a commandant fairly early on. And he was also the guy who helped launch their radio station, which was obviously a big part of it, Radio Rebelde. Rebel radio, that broadcast straight to the Cuban people. He set up shops, and he set up all kinds of facilities inside of their movement that would enable them to be more than just a bunch of random guerrilla fighters. And slowly but surely, they started to win over the people, and they won over a province and a mountainous region in the far west of Cuba. And slowly but surely, they started to gather momentum and ultimately managed to cut Cuba in half.
And I think it happens so often, Gareth, you know, the passion was with them. And many, many times in battles, it was 2-1 or even 10-1. But they were so passionate about what they believed in that they managed to overcome these forces that were much larger than them.
Yeah, he was also a very charismatic guy. There's no doubt. I mean, all of those pictures that are now so iconic show this man in the prime of his life. You know, he was a good-looking guy. He had this long hair. He wore a beret. He was always, you know, armed with some kind of weapon. And I think for many people, he was just such a hero, a folk hero, more than he was any kind of ideological or military hero at that stage. But ultimately, in the Battle of Santa Clara, that was the one where they actually ended up taking over and winning. It became the final decisive military victory of the revolution. And their eventual victory, despite being outnumbered, as you say, 10-1, remains, in the view of some observers, one of the most remarkable battles in human history. So, of course, from that point on, they started to build a new Cuba. And it turns out, as often happens with these things, that liberators are not always the best governors. And the Castros were very much entrenched, and they protected their power, and they started to develop a few rifts in the relationship between Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. And Che Guevara, while he was the brains of the business, really, because he was the only one with any kind of university education, who'd read a lot, who had an ideological basis and a philosophical basis for his ideas, he was slowly edged out, and he started to feel like he was almost unnecessary there.
But in the beginning, they did give him free rein. I mean, this is what sort of tarnished his reputation by many, that he ordered the killing of many, many people in the prisons. They say around 140 odd, which many people say, and then, yeah, he was just a murderer. But just after that, the United States obviously said, hang on, you know, now we've got a communist country right on our doorstep. And Shea went all around the world. And I think that the point you raised about the rift, they sort of felt that he was very militant, and it was better that he was traveling. So he went all around the world, and he actually ended up in the Soviet Union, and he was fundamental in organizing trade relations. So yeah. Cuba would give sugarcane to the Soviets, and in turn they'd give armaments and fuel. And this really started the whole story around the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis that plagued the Kennedy administration in the United States. The Bay of Pigs was a real big part of raising awareness of Shea, because he actually personally sent a message to John Kennedy to say, thank you very much for the Bay of Pigs, because it's just made us so much stronger. So I'm personally thanking you for that. Sarcastically.
Yeah. He ended up also going to North Korea, a place which very few people visited at that stage. But he was regaled as a hero in some of these countries. Yugoslavia, he met with Tito. He went to the Gaza Strip, and also obviously in Africa, where, you know, his reputation continues to be a source of inspiration for liberation movements and for left of center governments. So it's interesting that he managed to see a lot of the world, which at that time wasn't an easy thing to do if you were a you know, a military warlord or a terrorist, in inverted commas, as the United States had labeled him.
But also, he was a proper revolutionary. I think in the end, he wanted to spread his ideology and communism in as many places as he could. So, you know, Cuba wasn't going to hold him for long.
No. He decided to renounce his honorary Cuban citizenship, and he went off to the Congo. So he spent quite a bit of time in Africa. He was trying to help with the ongoing conflict in the Congo. And it wasn't very successful. I think that there were many people who had an interest in the Congo at the time. The Americans were very interested. It was basically a proxy war for the Cold War, which was ongoing at that stage. But Che spent a fair amount of time in the Congo and didn't manage to achieve very much. He wanted to export the revolution, you know, across the rest of Africa, and it didn't really work.
I think he was frustrated because he couldn't get the execution right. He just felt that the team he built up, he had Cubans with him, his loyal Cubans that came with him, I think there were about 100. But the rest, he couldn't really get them into a proper unit to make a difference in the Congo.
So eventually he gapped it there as well and went off to South America again, his home continent, and he headed straight for Bolivia, where he hoped also to instill interest in an independence movement, effectively. And he made a big speech on International Workers' Day, and decided that Bolivia was the best place to launch this new revolution. And he had absolute hell in terms of military lackluster performance and failure in the mountains of Bolivia. And he dealt with quite a lot. He thought he was just going to be dealing with the Bolivian military. But actually, the people of Bolivia weren't terribly interested in revolution either. Just a few years earlier, he'd been in Colombia and Peru, and he'd found that the local native Indian population were completely disinterested in revolution. So he had an uphill battle in every sense of the word.
There's a lot that shows the character of a man. So first of all, this can only happen in the 60s. I mean, he came in disguise into Bolivia. He put glasses on. He created a paunch. And then, rightly so, I mean, they got absolutely beaten up. And his girlfriend at the time, she got shot, and she was in terrible pain. They weren't sure if it was a girlfriend, but they believed there were some rumors that she was carrying his child at some point, et cetera, et cetera. And where they feel that they were involved was that he decided, no, he needs to go and find help for her, because she was really in trouble. And he walked great distances, and that's when he got captured, actually going to look for medical help for her.
Right. And there were informants, obviously, as well in the area, because they were hunting him down. I mean, there were people in the Bolivian government who were asking, you know, quite a large bounty for bringing in Guevara. So he was tied up. He was taken to a schoolhouse in La Higuera, and he asked to speak to the teacher. Her name was Julia Cortez. And she stated later that she found him to be an agreeable looking man with a soft and ironic glance. And his gaze was unbearable, piercing, and tranquil. So during their short conversation, he pointed out to her that the schoolhouse was in a very poor condition and said, this is no place for children to learn. And meanwhile, the government officials are driving Mercedes cars, and that is what we're fighting against. Of course, it was all wasted words, because he was set to be executed. Barrientos, who was the president of Bolivia, ordered him to be killed. And the next day, he was taken out into the courtyard, And he said to the guy who was going to shoot him, "You may as well just kill me, you coward. I'm just a man."
That's incredible. And the Bolivians were very worried, so they cut his hands off so that they had proof that they'd actually killed him. And then they got rid of the body because they were so scared of the pull that he had. And they also wanted to show that he was actually killed in battle rather than executed the way they actually did execute him.
That's right. They wanted to show that he had been killed in a shootout so that they didn't look like cowards who just shot him in captivity. And actually, they tied his body to the landing skids of a helicopter and flew it to a nearby town. And then they took photographs of him lying on a concrete slab in the laundry room. It's you know, these pictures are very sad and quite grisly. And as you say, they hid the corpse. They considered it to be like a relic that needed to be put away. Otherwise, it would have drawn all kinds of martyr tourists and people who believed that he was a man who'd had extraordinary powers and you know, commanded people through his charisma. And they didn't want it to become a place of homage.
But in the end, it did. The schoolhouse and all of those areas, the people got almost like a pilgrimage. Still, I think in 2017 was 50 years, and they had a massive commemoration. And the people in that town have said that's what keeps their town going. That's what drives the economy in their town.
Well, they also managed to find his diary, which, as I said earlier, was something he really kept a very dedicated, disciplined collection of poetry, short stories, thoughts, ideas, ideologies. And he'd written this all down, and his diary is now famous. I mean, it's kind of been published over and over again. It tells the story of the fights that he was involved in, the guerrilla warfare that they undertook. And it was translated a number of times. In fact, it's probably one of the most well-read books in South America.
Sure. And in the end, he became a legendary political figure, you know, and they equated to rebellion, revolution, socialism. The young people definitely, you know, there's T-shirts all over the place. The young people feel, you know, we want to rebel against the organized society, and they're all wearing these T-shirts.
Yeah, and I suppose his legacy is one of, you know, this incredibly charismatic human being. This really heroic image, but a man who even Nelson Mandela referred to as an inspiration for every person who loves freedom. I mean, that's what our own former president called him.
Yeah, that's correct. But he stuck very much to what he believed in. Nobody could change what he believed in.
Well, there he is, Che Guevara, a guy who became probably greater in death than he ever was in life. And there still continue to be places and buildings and streets named after him all over the world. His legacy continues on the T-shirts of so many students who have no idea of what he stood for, but who think that he looks like a cool image that makes them feel countercultural.
Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's an interesting story about Che Guevara before we leave him. Obviously, he was executed and they hid the body. Nobody really knew where it was. And there began a massive search for his remains. It lasted more than a year. And in 1997, not that long ago, a team of Cuban geologists and forensic anthropologists discovered the remnants of seven bodies in two mass graves, including one guy without hands, which was one of the things they wrote down when they killed him. And they showed the hands as a way of proving he was dead. So they got a little bit excited. But they excavated the teeth, and they perfectly matched a plaster mold of his teeth that was made in Cuba just prior to his Congolese expedition. That obviously helped to make the whole thing official. And the clincher was that the anthropologist inspected inside a hidden pocket of a blue jacket that was dug up next to the handless cadaver and found a small bag of pipe tobacco. So they said that had to be the proof that this was obviously Che Guevara.
CliffCentral.com